Well, firstly, to setting the agenda, disaster resilience strategies, and as Melinda was saying, it's an honour to welcome the Attorney General. Robert McClelland is the Attorney General and member for Barton, an electorate based in the St George area. He entered Parliament in 1996, and before entering Parliament, he practised as a lawyer for 14 years, specialising in industrial and sports law. He was born on Australia Day 1958, which of course is very auspicious for a political career. His interests include Australian history, surfing and rugby league, and no need to ask him which club he supports. Robert, welcome along.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks very much for that introduction. First, may I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we meet on and pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. Can I acknowledge also Melinda Howes and Mr Robert Whelan. John Tobridge, the chair of the Natural Disaster Insurance Review Panel, I understand will be coming later in the day if he's not here, and distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great pleasure to join you here today and to talk about these very important issues. As Attorney General, I have responsibility for emergency management issues, and that is, or flowed from, if you like, the Attorney General, the previous Attorney General's responsibilities, which I inherited in the counter-terrorism area. They are seen as being related, that is, the emergency response capability responding to either a terrorist event or a natural disaster. The reality in Australia is such that the likelihood of having to respond to a natural disaster is obviously far more relevant in terms of our history and, to be frank, inevitability. Competence and diligence, we are striving and have every prospect of preventing a terrorist event on our shores, and that is certainly what we aspire to. But we cannot prevent natural disasters, and hence it is most appropriate today that we focus on probably the most devastating of all natural disasters, certainly in terms of loss, and that is in respect to floods. Those natural disasters that we've seen and which have been outlined obviously take their toll physically, emotionally, and also financially. It looks like the Queensland floods are going to be the most costly natural disaster in Australia's history, certainly in terms of property loss. We saw the Treasurer in his budget speech highlight that the floods and Cyclone Yasi combined will probably reduce economic growth by about half a percentage point. The reconstruction effort is going to place significant demands on labour and is already impacting on consumer prices. It's likely to cost the economy about $9 billion in lost output. In terms of direct government contributions, the government has already given an advance of $1 billion to Queensland to start rebuilding. We will also be providing another $1 billion in advance, and $50 million for Cyclone Yasi has already been provided, but the bill is likely to be significantly higher than that, and that is also on top of some $500 million that we have given Victoria in response to their floods over the summer season. Nationally, more than $800 million has been provided to people in the immediate aftermath of the disasters. They're in the Australian Government Disaster Recovery Payments. They're the payments of $1,000 per adult and $400 per child. That is on top of the natural disaster relief and recovery arrangements that the Commonwealth and state governments have entered into. And in addition, almost 62,000 payments of the disaster income recovery subsidy has been granted to small businesses, farmers and people who have lost their jobs, and that totals some $72 million. It's estimated that the Commonwealth's contribution to the natural disasters around Australia for the last summer season is in the order of $6 billion. The reality is that the arrangements have been structured in such a manner, and the culture has developed to such an extent that I think the informal situation has become, at least, that the Australian taxpayer has become the default insurer of last resort to these natural disasters, and it is my submission that is not sustainable and must be addressed. Certainly the disaster season, even before the disaster season, going back to the response to the Victorian National bushfire, there was very worthwhile inquiry in the Royal Commission to aspects of emergency response. But I think the extent of the loss which has occurred this last season causes us to ask and really question whether we are taking the right approach. And I'm not just saying at a federal level, at a whole of government level, and indeed at a community level. Are we making people less exposed, less at risk to natural disasters? I'm not sure that we are. There are measures happening, but I think the focus has been very heavily and understandably very heavily on the consequences of a disaster, that is the response after the event. But I think people would say that the primary policy objective should be on a preventative action or minimising action that can minimise the impact of a natural disaster and, of course, have the greatest prospects of saving lives and preventing injury. Certainly after a disaster we hear the obligations, and they are obligations on government to do everything reasonable that reasonably can be done to help people get back on their feet, to return to a normal life, and governments of all persuasions keep faith with those sentiments. But we need to ask whether that focus on the past event is actually reducing the capacity of Australians individually, as businesses and as communities to respond effectively to those challenges. It is counterproductive, for instance, if government assistance actually acts as a disincentive to people taking their own measures and to develop their own resilience. For instance, I referred to the natural disaster relief and recovery payments. In most states, the eligible payment for contents for someone who suffers loss of their contents is about $8,000. If you were a renter, why would you bother taking out insurance? Because the government will pay that. In addition, there is compensation for the for loss, a certain extent of the loss of the damage, plus those personal payments. Are we looking sufficiently at those issues that have been discussed, issues of relocating after events? And certainly that is being considered in the Lockyer Valley, I note. Are we doing enough to apply proper zoning protocols, to develop building codes in these areas? We certainly need to be more strategic. The evidence suggests that on these Australian Government disaster recovery payments and the other payments to which I've referred, that people have been paid five times, have been paid out five times over the past 5 years in respect to flooding that has occurred, as it is predicted to occur. Are we as a community sensible in adopting that strategy? Obviously, the people are entitled to assistance, but should we be doing more to ensure that that home isn't flooded out, either as a result of levies, as a result of relocation, or proper building codes? Certainly, in terms of future residents, it should be an imperative. And I note that the Institute of Actuaries has actually made a submission to the Queensland Flood Inquiry, which is welcome, and they appropriately said that mitigation actions are needed to effectively manage this flood risk. Without clear signals to encourage more active engagement by the public, this will continue to cause economic hardship. And they're absolutely right. We have heard that this last summer has been an extraordinary season for natural disasters. I received a delegation of scientists and said they advised me, well, hold your horses. It may not be extraordinary. It may be the sign of things to come, given that climate change suggests that we are going to suffer from more extreme and more frequent severe weather events. Mitigation, obviously, is vitally important Experts suggest that $1 invested in mitigation saves at least two. Indeed, experts suggest that probably more than that. And if you look at some of the successful levee banks around, for instance, Lismore, I think that's one example, but elsewhere, where unquestionably that has already paid itself off in terms of the damage that it has prevented to the local community. But I mentioned priorities. I mentioned that we have paid over $800 million out in those individual payments, as well as the contribution we are making to the state governments. They're the $1,000 payments. I noted with interest Gerry Harvey saying that there had been a slump in retail sales other than in Queensland. And certainly I think the Australian community feels an obligation to assist those who have experienced suffering in a natural disaster, the adverse consequences, but equally are those funds being used to purchase a generator to cope with the next natural disaster? Are they being used to acquire insurance to cover the future loss? Are they being used to make renovations to their building? Or are they being used in some cases, at least, and I wouldn't say generally, but in some cases, the evidence suggests perhaps for plasma TV sets. Now, that is $800 million that we have paid out in those individual payments. We, at the other end, over a four-year period, we pay $110 million towards mitigation measures. That's jointly, that's the state's co-contribute, the equivalent additional sum. But if you look at what we are putting into mitigation as opposed to what is going out after the event, there is absolutely no comparison. Are we doing enough? Certainly the culture is shifting around Australia to focus on this concept of resilience, and that is obviously to do what can be done to prepare for, to prevent and respond to, bounce back from a natural disaster. And the Council of Australian Governments just this February adopted the Natural Disaster Resilience Strategy, which essentially looks at all arms of government and the obligations that they have. And this goes right into the planning issues, local government planning, local government building code decisions, and indeed issues of insurance. And unquestionably, a significant part of that strategy is having appropriate information. Most relevantly, when we're talking about floods, is flood mapping data. And in that sense, the Victorian Bushfire Royal Commission actually recommended that households be given advice as to what their disaster risk rating was in respect to, in that case, fires, but obviously floods. These sort of issues are being considered as part of that strategy. But the reality is we also need to look at restructuring communities for the future. There is certainly a lot of resistance and understandable resistance in the community in terms of impacting on existing households, actually uprooting a family and forcing them to move. But certainly in terms of future plan, that may in fact be a desirable thing, as we're seeing in the Lockyer Valley. But certainly in terms of future decisions, all these factors have to be factored in. Insurance has been identified in all strategies as being particularly important. Are we still a country of rugged individuals who have the capacity to respond to these inevitable natural disasters, the things of legend in our country, or as a result of the strategies that we are developing, and in particular the desire to assist people after the event, which is understandable, but are we, by that assistance, taking their focus off what they can do to make themselves more resilient, including where they build, how they build, and what protections they have for themselves through insurance coverage. And if they have that protection for themselves, and we can encourage that culture of protecting themselves through that coverage and through those other preventative measures, there is certainly a far less burden on the economy, and certainly a far less burden on future generations. So there is a long way to go if we are going to shift this culture to focus on both preventative measures at a whole of government level, to really instill in the community a sense of individual responsibility, business responsibility and community resilience. This is receiving a considerable amount of attention now, but how we get there is always the challenge, and I'll be certainly interested in any contributions that you may make to that topic. Thank you.
So the Attorney-General is going to take some questions, and if you'd like to call in with yours, you can do so on that number, 0402 293 251. Robert, you're asking people to do more for themselves, and by and large people know if they're in flood-prone area, and so do insurance companies. Who's going to pay the super premiums required to insure for floods?
Well, this is a challenge in itself. It may be, for instance, that areas are zoned so that if someone is going to build in an area where they are repeatedly flooded out year in, year out, that the certainly for the future at least, governments need to work together and to mandate insurance. I think we need to work not only with the insurance industry, but also with the banking industry. Should the banks be requiring their borrowers to have insurance for these natural disasters? Part of the problem is now that the culture is so weighted against or disincentivising insurance that the pool of insurers is so low that the cost of insurance is so high. I think we need to focus on expanding that pool of insurers. If information is presented, and there probably will be areas once effective mapping is undertaken that insurers won't sensibly insure, then it may well become a role for government to look at what it can do to step in and either subsidise or cover that. But I think before we get to that point, we need to do the effective mapping, and we certainly need to increase the level of insurance throughout the broader community.
How do you expand the pool of insurers?
Well, the good question, and this is I'll be keen to hear from the experts, but the Standing Committee, the Ministerial Committee of Police and Emergency Management Ministers is looking at that issue precisely as to what can be done to remove the disincentives on insurance, and certainly the Bill Shorten's task force is looking at that issue as well. I think looking at the level of post-event subsidies is something to be examined. As I say, we've got these two levels, the natural disaster relief and recovery arrangements, the joint federal and state payments, which include personal hardship payments. We have an unmeans-tested Australian government disaster relief and recovery payment. I think politicians on both sides trying to do the right thing by their communities are very, very vocal after an event to say, well, my area should be designated as eligible for these individual payments. But collectively, that is, politicians from both sides collectively, we're actually diminishing the resources that are available to go into mitigation and preventative measures, spending, as I say, the last season, $800 million. Only a fraction of that is going into preventing further events. So I think we as political representatives collectively need to look at what we're doing to keep our future generation safe, to prevent the loss that they may sustain, and I think the culture currently isn't sufficiently focused on that.
You used the word mandate, that people would be mandated to take out insurance. Now, for those in flood-prone areas, that would be very expensive. If there were not some scheme of community rating.
Well, again, I think in any of these public policy areas, I think there needs to be grandfathering provisions. People who are living in their homes, living in areas, obviously the status quo, that is the existing state of affairs, is inevitably going to be maintained. That is simply a political imperative, I think, whichever side of Parliament is in power. But I think for future decisions, once an area is zoned as being literally and inevitably going to flood, a couple of things should happen. The council should, the local government should say, well, you do not build in that area a nursing home, a hospital, anything where people may need to be evacuated regularly to maintain their safety. But if someone is going to build in that area, two things. One, they should build a property that can withstand it. Obviously, the concept of properties on stilts, and I note that General Slater has recommended a particular design to withstand the tidal surges in cyclone areas, to look at that sort of model. But there may well be some areas, and I'm not simply in floods, but for instance, some areas that are so prone to bushfire exposure that the council should say, listen, if you are going to build in there, all the experts say you are going to confront a fire, you are going to confront a flood. If you want to build there, you should understand that the condition of your building there is that you maintain an insurance policy.
Well, you know, when you talk about bushfire-prone areas, you're talking about very large sections of Australia for a start.
Having said that, I visited King Lake shortly after the Victorian Bushfire Royal Commissions on the top of a ridge. The ground had, I'm not sure of the expression, but crystallised, had become glass. Mm. The sand had just melted. And in the street that I was in, a number of little kids lost their lives. I don't think property should be rebuilt there. I think it was far too great a risk. I think governments need to have the courage to say the risk of loss of life in this situation is too great. Equally, the areas covered by the some of that flash flooding where lives were lost, I think there needs to be careful consideration as to whether a property should be built in the path of that potential risk. I mean, these things are forgotten in 50 years' time, but we owe it to families and kids living in homes in 50 years' time to prevent those sort of things occurring again.
Now, there are a number of specific questions by SMS, which I'll come to in just one moment, but by the way, I visited Victoria's bushfire areas some months ago, and there'd been very little rebuilding in those areas that had been destroyed. People have obviously been frozen by the difficulties of making choices about what to do. But that, leaving that aside, when you say areas that are, for example, known to be flood-prone would be grandfathered, that's a big concession.
Look, I think there's a couple of ways of doing it. I think you are inevitably... We need to bring the community with us on all this. You inevitably take out a lot of opposition if you say you live there, your rights are the same as they have been, you have those, you will continue to have those rights. However, again, looking at the Lockyer Valley, the local government is making some very sensible offers about property swap, and a lot can be done to encourage people to take that, swap their position for safer land. Obviously, compelling them is going to strike resistance, but offering incentives is something that can be done. But I think most certainly for future planning decisions, these things should be made. Also, if I can just briefly say, after an event, the rhetoric of the politicians, of the media, of the local communities are, we will restore it. We will restore things as they are. That can be a recipe for future disaster, and so often is a recipe for future disaster. We shouldn't let it happen if it's going to be a recipe for future loss of life. In some circumstances, the lessons are so profound that things do need to change, and in those circumstances, I think governments at all level need to make the call.
Let's go to some of the SMS questions. Would the government insure those in high-risk areas if insurers won't accept the risk?
This is certainly an important. Certainly an important topic that is going to be examined by these committees, and certainly there are examples overseas where that is the case. These are issues that we're looking at. The aim initially is to again expand that pool of insurance so that there is a greater take up of insurance. If there are areas and there may be limited areas, and I think it will only be limited areas where insurance isn't viable, then what the role of government, be it federal, state or local, is something that we need to have a frank conversation about.
Another question, which is a bit of a refinement on that one, would the government consider something similar to the terrorism pool or the medical indemnity blue sky scheme for flood and other natural disasters in Australia? And if not, why not?
Well, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, we had a seminar about a month ago, and we had a presentation on the terrorism reinsurance pool. That was established because there was a market failure to provide insurance for a terrorism event. The advice from those managing the pool was that you would only consider that if there was a market failure. We haven't established we collectively at all levels of government and the community established an effective market for insurance because we haven't publicised the data both to insurers and to those who would reside in those areas to establish a rational debate as to their risks and properly costing that risk. We need to do that first before we determine whether there is a market failure, certainly a market failure in specific areas. But again, obviously, we looked at the terrorism disaster financing scheme as well as some other schemes around the area. But to avoid being long-winded, I think we really need to focus on having the market as effective as we can be before we go there.
In the US, hardship payments are a loan which is repayable. What are your thoughts on that?
These are issues. I mean, would it be more sensible to have these $1,000 payments as an advance on a tax refund? Should there be some requirement that the funds are spent on making that household more resilient? Now, that may obviously be it may be essential for them to have food and accommodation and so forth. Obviously, but again, is giving these $1,000 payments in circumstances where people were isolated for 24 hours but had otherwise their facilities, their power off for 48 hours, irrespective of their means, irrespective of their ability to stay in holiday accommodation or whatever it may be, rather than focusing firstly and foremost on those genuinely in need, not to say that those recipients who got the money weren't in need and didn't suffer hardship, but again, is it being targeted as effectively as it can be? And I think, to be frank, given the political pressure from all sides and the imperative to provide relief and the reactionary response to these events, I think is taking our eye off the ball collectively as to what part of these resources could actually be put into preventing these events.
I think it's right to say, this is aside from the SMS questions, that those people in Victoria affected by the bushfires who have depended on government recompense have got nowhere near what their insurable losses would be had they had insurance.
I think that is a fair, depending on their circumstances, whether they are the renters and the like. This again is part of a public education campaign to point this out to them, to look at making insurance affordable. And the advice that came through this conference is simply to advise people of their risk. There are some councils, for instance, that have adopted the strategy of annually writing to households saying, we would like to remind you that you are living in an area which is prone to bushfire or prone to flooding. We would recommend that you review your insurance policies. The evidence suggests that where that is done, there is a much, much higher take-up of insurance because of that community knowledge. So I think what we need to focus on is not only the government strategy, the private sector strategy, but also community engagement and education.
Another SMS question. Some politicians favour forcing insurers to offer full flood cover at capped rates. Will you absolutely rule that out?
Well, again, what we want to do is to work and undertake to make the market as informed and as effective as it can be, and to look at those areas where insurance is not viable from a commercial point of view. Now, the goal is to reduce those areas, and then we'll adopt strategies as to how we cope with that.
So we're in the summary stage. What do you want from the insurance industry?
Firstly, I want to work with the insurance industry to get as much information as we can to develop our mapping, and that project is considerably underway. Queensland needs to do that. That is, the Queensland local government authorities need to be far more cooperative in working with the insurance industry. Having exchanged that information, we want to sit down and have a frank dialogue as to costing areas that are at risk, what policy options can be, what insurance policy options can be made available to the public, and sitting down and working through in respect to those areas which cannot viably be insured commercially as to what alternative arrangements might be available for them. So that's a body of work, but an important body of work.
There's a certain sense of urgency here because it seems every summer we have a series of disasters. I mean, what do you see the timing as before these things are beyond the option stage and some decisions are being made?
Oh, they are important. They are important and they are urgent. Certainly from the insurance point of view, we would like to have a bedded down a direction and a solid direction before the next summer or disaster season. But I think generally engaging the community in these preventative strategies is absolutely imperative. Again, we saw arising from the Victorian Bushfire Royal Commission a willingness that jolted all governments around Australia to develop a national emergency warning system, the telecommunications warning system, and I expect there will be recommendations that come out of the Flood Royal Commission that will similarly jolt governments around Australia into working on some of these preventative measures.
Thank you very much. Your coming here underlines the importance of this meeting today, and we appreciate very much your taking time to come and talk to us this morning.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you. Can you accept a bottle of wine without having to declare it?
I can.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you.